Welcome to the Burt Cohen Show. Liberty and freedom for all of us, all persons, all sovereign entities, each one of us. This is government of, by, and for the people, or persons, I would think it would be. But there's something called corporate personhood. You know about that, that corporations in America have similar rights as individuals. I don't think they necessarily have the same responsibilities as individuals, but they do have the same rights. And luckily, somebody in a position to do something about it is doing something about it. Just to the left of the state of New Hampshire, and I mean that quite literally, is the state of Vermont. And we have with us on the Burt Cohen Show, State Senator from Williston, Vermont, Virginia Lyons. Ginny, thanks very much for being with us. And you have put in a resolution into the Vermont State Senate to do something about the idea of corporate personhood. Thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. How did that resolution come about? What prompted you to do it?
Thanks, Burt, and thank you for having me on your show. What prompted me to do it, of course, was I think what a lot of people felt when the Citizens United case was decided by the Supreme Court, allowing for corporations to give lots of money to in campaigns and not to be restricted as they might have been in the McCain-Feingold law. So there are a lot of people who were upset by that decision, including myself. It undermines our, you know, some of the fundamental principles of our democracy when we give these rights to businesses. And but beyond that, I was approached by a number of citizens in my district and in the state who were interested in having a bill or resolution introduced that would be able to change that Supreme Court decision. And so, you know, from that came the resolution that I have introduced along with others in the Senate. And it, I'm looking forward to having it acted upon this session.
Now, Vermont is a unique place, a wonderful, beautiful place, a lot of great history there. Is there a lot of support across the aisle? You, I assume, are a Democrat, but I would think a lot of people, including some of the new Republicans, new, you know, kind of hard right Republicans, might also be in support of something like this with regard to rights and responsibilities.
Yeah, I believe they will be. When I went to get signatures, unfortunately, I didn't spend a lot of time doing it, so I don't have Republican signatures on it. But I have heard from some of the Republicans in our Senate that they will be supportive of it. I haven't heard anyone against it.
I can't
let's put it that way. And I've also had a lot of feedback from legislators and citizens across the country who are expressing support for what we're doing.
Well, if it starts in Vermont, perhaps it'll continue elsewhere. The legal concept of corporate personhood, of course, came into being well before the monumental Supreme Court decision on Citizens United. When was the legal fiction of corporate personhood enshrined? Was it the Tillman Act of 1907? When did corporations become legal persons?
Well, that's interesting. First of all, just going back to the founders, our you know, the writers of the Constitution.
The good guys, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at some of the letters that John Adams wrote, he was very clear that he had concerns about the commercial enterprise, industrial enterprise, becoming more powerful than individual citizens. And that was sort of his caution based on some of, you know, the revolutionary events that had taken place in the Revolutionary War. But the first Supreme Court decision was rendered in 1885, a 100 years after, about more or less, after our country was founded. And that it really wasn't even a decision. You know, back in the 1800s, we didn't have digital or other recording devices, so there were clerks sitting with the Supreme Court justices as they discussed their decisions. And one of the clerks listened to the Chief Justice, then Chief Justice Waite, as he was commenting on a decision in the Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company. And the justice stated that that he thought that all justices agreed that the 14th Amendment's prohibition denying equal protection to a person would also apply to a state's treatment of private corporations. The way that comment was written down became the force of a decision. And it was so that while the intent may have been that we certainly would like to have laws that will protect our corporate enterprise, the way it was written down was that corporations would receive the same benefits as the 14th Amendment, which is, I believe was written for equal protection after the Civil War. So so therein lies sort of a comment becoming a very powerful determinant as we went into history. The Tillman Act that you mentioned, really, and I reference in my resolution, was really the act that prohibited corporate contributions to federal election campaigns.
Yeah.
So the Citizens United case overturns the Tillman Act that we've been living under since 1907.
Wow.
So now we're faced with large corporations having the capacity really to change the footprint of our political landscape in a way that they haven't before. And as you mentioned earlier, what's really discouraging is that they're not currently held to the same standard that we as citizens are. they're products of people, and but now they're given all the rights that people have under the Constitution.
And we are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Vermont State Senator Virginia Lyons about her resolution, getting the ball rolling, perhaps across the country, to change corporate personhood. So, what does your bill do about corporate personhood? The way it works is, as I understand it, it's a resolution urging members of Congress to do this, to start the process to amend the Constitution.
Yes, it is, and it is a resolution. It is non-binding. But it does send a strong sentiment to our congressional delegation. And just incidentally, I was talking with our Congressman Peter Welch a couple of days ago, and he's very supportive of this resolution. So, which is good to hear. And I think other members of our delegation will be equally supportive. But so right now, the resolution has been placed in our Government Operations Committee, and senators will, I testified there, I may testify again on the resolution. They will take additional testimony from folks supportive or not so supportive and listen. They may make changes to the resolution, but then
sure.
it would go to the full Senate for a vote.
Mm-hmm.
And to the House for a vote, and I think we'll have I think we'll have strong success in both bodies.
I think
it will pass out of the legislature, and I'm sure the governor will be supportive. He was not happy with the Citizens United case decision either.
I'll bet. And what are some of the real problems that an average person might recognize from the legal fiction of corporate personhood? How does corporate personhood interfere and upset the balance, what's supposed to be a level playing field that all persons, all American citizens must abide by? How specifically does it upset the balance that's so egregious?
Well, you've asked the $1,000 question. First and foremost, that just thinking about the decision that was rendered by Citizens United, businesses, large corporations, will have the money to put into media, to put into advertising, to put into marketing for selected candidates across the country. And I think we as individual citizens cannot compete with that level of speech. You know, we have a hard enough time right now trying to meet and listen to our folks who are running for elected positions to be inundated with all sorts of negative, positive, perhaps bordering on truthfulness, campaign materials and information.
It's being kind.
It's going to get worse and worse.
Yes.
And so that, for me, that's one.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an elected official, I'd like to know that our elections are for people and that people, individuals, are engaged in the discourse, not corporate marketing.
And that's one thing that seems to me quite evident, that the intent of the founders and the people who participated in our own secession from Mother England was that we did not want to have an aristocracy rule us. We wanted to govern ourselves, that the person, the individual, is sovereign, really. The government works for we, the people. And to have the system now where it basically is, I mean, it's absolutely not a level playing field. The power of the corporate persons is very like an aristocracy.
Well, I call it a corporatocracy.
Right.
And, you know, it does does change what we mean by a democracy.
Yes.
We've never equated having capital or money with being a free citizen. And I think that's what our founding fathers tried to get away from with the Boston Tea Party.
Yeah.
That was from what I understand, it's as much a rebellion against the tax as it was against the trading company, the West Indian Trading Company. So, we're going to go backwards. We can't go backwards. We really can't allow for this to continue.
Now, how does it... Obviously, certain corporations were very much in favor of creating the legal entity of corporate personhood. Why, if I were, a totally greedy, self-interested corporation that cared not one bit for the common good, I know, amazing concept that anybody could be like that, but how does it serve the corporate interests? Why is it in their interest to be a person? What rights does it confer on them, and any avoidance of responsibility?
Well, first of all, think about all the laws that we currently have that restrict corporate corporations. There are antitrust provisions. I guess I can't speak to that, but there may be implications for that. There are environmental laws that we have in place. Certainly New Hampshire and Vermont are very concerned about the environment, and there may be those laws that would that a corporation could say don't give me equal protection. There are certainly laws for labor within the corporate enterprise, where we currently protect our workers in ways that, you know, are so important and help us to stand apart from other countries. But those laws may well be in jeopardy. So allowing, so I just think there are a number of areas that are of great concern. We have a business organization in Vermont called the Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, and their concerns are they like to see themselves as the good corporations, the good businesses, and I do see them that way. They have joined me in supporting this resolution. So there are businesses who do support this initiative because they understand the how problematic it is to give rights to a corporation rather than to an individual.
Well, Ginny, Senator Lyons, whatever, you know, I as an individual, you as an individual, could be sued in court. But I believe one of the things about corporate personhood is a corporation can be sued, but it shields the individuals. Is that right? I mean, how does it serve the individuals who make up this legal fiction called a corporate person? You know, it gives them rights, but does it protect them from the same responsibilities that each of us as an individual, real flesh and blood human has?
No, and they don't vote. And will they vote? I mean, one of the responsibilities and privileges of being an individual in a democracy is casting a vote. And currently, corporations don't do that.
Right.
Are we opening the door to that kind of process? When we equate money with free speech,
yes,
that leaves some of us in the dust. As you were saying before, this allows for corporations to sue municipalities, to sue states, to sue government entities generally, in a way that I think we have avoided in the past.
But the individuals in a corporation are protected from suit, are they not, by the concept of corporate personhood?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Sorry.
I believe that it's the case that the individuals who make up a corporation cannot be sued for something the corporation does, because the corporation is a separate person. So individuals can be punished for a crime committed. Can a corporate person be punished for a crime committed?
I don't think so, not unless they're taken to court through a long, protracted system. So, you're answering some questions that will be important for us to consider in all of this as we go forward with a resolution. And, certainly how we function in the judicial system is one of those.
Yeah.
And who's held accountable and how...
Right.
Yeah, the accountability piece is absolutely huge.
Yes.
So, and I am reminded. I have a quote here from Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor in her dissenting opinion in the Citizens United case.
Right.
She said she was talking about the Supreme Court judges. They created corporations as persons, gave birth to corporations as persons. And there could be an argument made that that was the court's error to start with,
mm-hmm.
imbuing a creature of state law with human characteristics. And then from that can flow all of the concepts that you're talking about.
Wow. We are talking with Vermont State Senator Virginia Lyons, who is sponsoring a resolution calling on Congress to amend the Constitution to do away with the concept of corporate personhood. Justice Sotomayor touches on an interesting point that, you know, giving birth, we humans, we are all given birth to. We die.
Yes, we do.
Corporations, corporate persons don't die. Isn't that
They're
correct?
They're immortal, potentially immortal. Right. So it would be a different way of looking at government of and by and for the people. of and by and for the corporation would be just a whole different outlook on our future. I think it's quite depressing to think about it. The other area that, you know, that we think about as free trade agreements are negotiated in this country, the corporations play a huge role in that process. So some of the prescription drug companies, or pharma as an organization, plays a role in determining what the conditions will be in free trade agreements. Some of those free trade agreements go against state programs, state laws.
And we don't know the
consequences completely of what may happen if corporations are able then to challenge those laws, whether it's under free trade or whether it's under equal protection or free speech or any of the other rights that are granted to individual citizens. So the issue goes from the local, the state, the national, and the global in its implications.
It certainly does. The power is granted to these fictions. I mean, there is no such thing as a corporate person. Yeah, absolutely
no.
Right.
Now, no. Well, I mean, we need to be clear, though. We know artificial persons have been defined in U.S. law. Artificial persons have been defined in state laws. I mean, for convenience and for the sake of allowing for contract negotiations
right.
within and between corporate entities, that's fine. But to say that they have the same rights in the negotiation process as you or I would have, or the right to organize in the same way that you or I would have, would be inappropriate. Or think about the right to assemble as a right that's granted to individuals.
Right.
And within that, we're allowed to assemble and form corporate entities. But then if we say that corporations have the right to assemble, does that mean that antitrust laws
Ooh.
Would be
Moot.
Unconstitutional? It's a question, a legitimate question that we might ask.
Wow, interesting. Well, it's always good, from my own experience in the New Hampshire Senate, to know what the other side is going to say before they say it. what do you think the corporate persons, the people who back corporate personhood, I can't expect that they'll give up without a struggle. What do you expect that they will say the benefits to the common good are from corporate personhood?
Well, because that will allow for them to provide a strong economy for our country and for people. And, you know, I so frequently hear, for example, that without unions, there would be greater profit, or without unions, there would be more jobs. And somehow we've forgotten the value of having unionized labor in so many different areas. So I think there are places where we'll begin to see some of the same old issues and struggles that we've seen in the past be important to both corporations and to others as we go forward with this.
So you don't think, Senator Lyons, you don't think if the Constitution were so amended that the corporate personhood could no longer be, that it would hurt the American economy, particularly in competing with the world marketplace?
Absolutely not. You know, we didn't rise to the economic and cultural power that we are, social power that we are today, and political power that we are today by having corporate leadership. Corporations serve a really important role in our economy and
sure.
as a foundation of our economy, but it's not all about corporate rule. It's about people and how we make those decisions that affect people. Corporate decisions are made for profit and to build profit, and that's all well and good.
Sure,
but there are other elements in our society that are probably even more important. Freedom of speech, just going through all
democracy.
Of the...
democracy.
Yeah, just go right through.
Keep
the
up.
Right to vote, the right to have self-determination, yeah. The right to build our communities as we would like them to reflect who we are in our own individual states. So
there is a lot riding us at the level playing field. Well, if people from other parts of the United States are interested in being supportive and tracking what's going on there, perhaps emulating your resolution, how can they best get information?
Well, you know, I think the best way, that of course, there is a national group that is looking at this and has been working hard on this, and that's the movetoamend.org. They have a resolution out online. Folks who are interested in the resolution that I've introduced here in Vermont can go to the Vermont Legislative website. The number of the resolution is JSR. It's a Joint Senate Resolution number 11. So they could look that up. And then beyond that, I think it's really important for people to, you know, they can read the Constitution. That would be a great thing. And then to contact and communicate with your local representatives, your state senators.
Yes.
I have to tell you, I have been thrilled with the positive comments that I've gotten from everywhere, from Patagonia and Uganda to Wisconsin, California, Florida, Texas, and so on. So across the country, people are really, really supportive, and that's a good thing. So contacting folks, talking with folks, getting a greater understanding of the implications of corporate personhood is very important. And having some local businesses who are socially responsible get on board is also very important. There are a lot of things to do, and of course, contacting our Government Operations Committee here in the state of Vermont won't hurt at all.
Senator Virginia Lyons from the capital of the world, Williston, Vermont. Thank you so much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show, and we will be tracking it as people will be across the world. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Bert. It's been a pleasure.
Good luck. Equal rights under the law. Yeah, what a great concept that is. We're going to shift gears just a little bit, talk about another legal issue, a big one. You may have heard that very recently a federal judge in Florida, U.S. District Judge Roger Vinson, a Reagan appointee, struck down the Affordable Care Act, which has been derisively called Obamacare, the really bipartisan health care reform, which passed. He struck it down. And his basic ruling was that since the individual mandate to purchase insurance, he believes, is unconstitutional, the entire law is void. So this is a biggie. And I want to find out more about it, and I imagine you do too. And our guest right now on the Bert Cohen Show is UNH law professor John Grebe, an expert in constitutional law. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, happy to join you, Bert.
Well, Professor Grebe, before joining the law school full-time, he was a professor at Vermont Law School, again, across the river, earned his BA in classics, magna cum laude, I'm impressed, from Dartmouth College in 1985 and got a JD from Harvard Law School in 88. And he has a legal practice that focuses on federal appeals and is admitted to practice before the U.S. Supreme Court. How did this happen on strictly constitutional grounds? How strong, how solid is Judge Vinson's argument? This has been tested in other courts before, and he, Judge Vinson, seems to be kind of striking out on his own. How strong is his argument? Does the requirement in the Affordable Care Act that the individual must purchase health care violate the rights of a person according to the Constitution?
Well, I think it's a very vulnerable ruling. He is not the only one who has decided this. A federal district judge in Virginia also held that the individual mandate was unconstitutional. By contrast, two federal district judges elsewhere in the country have upheld the constitutionality of the mandate. So at this point, we're split 2-2. He is the first judge to have held that the mandate is integral to the statutory scheme as a whole, and that by holding the mandate unconstitutional, the rest of the act must fall as well. So that aspect of his ruling really grabs attention, because it means that the entire bill is unconstitutional if this ruling were to be upheld.
So I'm looking at a quote here. I believe it's from the judge who was concerned, Judge Vinson, who made this ruling. He says, "It's not hyperbolizing," not a word one uses every day, "it is not hyperbolizing to suggest that Congress could do almost anything it wanted. It is difficult to imagine that a nation which began, at least in part, the result of opposition to a British mandate giving the East India Tea Company a monopoly," which we spoke about on the first half of the Bert Cohen Show, "a monopoly and imposing a nominal tax on all tea sold in America, would have set out to create a government with the power to force people to buy tea in the first place. If Congress can penalize a passive individual for failing to engage in commerce," and that's what we're talking about, the Commerce Clause, I guess, "the enumeration of powers in the Constitution would have been in vain, for it would be difficult to perceive any limitation on federal power." Comments on that quote from Judge Vinson, please.
Well, there's a bunch of interesting stuff embedded within that quote. First of all, is his clear acceptance of the constitutional theory of originalism, i.e. that the Constitution must be interpreted always in line with what those who at the founding would have understood it to mean. And that in and of itself is a controversial point. It's not a point of view that is universally shared, though it is, of course, accepted by a number of very, very important and prominent justices and legal commentators. The second part of that, which is interesting, is the fact that, you know, he's right, really, in a sense, that if Congress concludes that something has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, then, in fact, it would be within Congress's power to regulate that. So if in some, you know, wild scenario, Congress did conclude that an individual's decision not to purchase tea did, in fact, substantially affect interstate commerce, under settled authority, Congress would have the power to require such a purchase. But that begs the question, is there some other part of the Constitution that would nonetheless prohibit Congress from requiring such a purchase? You know, my immediate reaction is yes. I mean, barring, you know, unforeseen and unforeseeable circumstances, passing a federal law which requires an individual to purchase a specific commodity,
right,
would doubtless be regarded as an infringement of liberty protected by the Due Process Clauses of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. But, you know, it's an argument that's made against expanding federal power. It's an argument that has been going on since the founding. It's an argument that has been made with greater voice in the last 15 years or so, again, since the Rehnquist Court did renew federalism as something that the Supreme Court would enforce and did return to imposing some limits on Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. Now, this was a debate that when I went to law school in the 80s was thought to have been long settled. It was a debate that culminated in Roosevelt's court packing plan in 1937 and the Supreme Court's subsequent retreat from an agenda by which the court struck down aspects of the New Deal. But, you know, and it was it's an argument that goes right back to the founding and is probably going to be with us for as long as we are a nation.
Well, certainly many people with the Tea Party, which I guess is now the Republican Party, have certainly entered that discussion on the side, it appears, of states' rights having primacy, that the states should be more sovereign than the federal government, and that this law, like other laws that Congress has done, kind of interferes with their perception of states' rights. Is this part of that same discussion, do you think?
It is, absolutely. I mean, the specific arguments being made here are novel. There were two aspects of this ruling. First of all, Judge Vinson, and this has received less attention, he actually rejected an argument by the plaintiffs in this case that the expansion of Medicaid that is contemplated by Obamacare, that was unconstitutional, that it was a coercive use of the spending power. And that argument is basically that, well, to back up a step, when Congress spends money, Congress is entitled to put conditions on the receipt of federal funds. That, for example, is how Congress ensures that there's a uniform drinking age around the country. It conditions it conditions the states imposing a 21-year-old drinking age. It makes that a condition of the receipt of certain federal highway funds. Sometimes it has been argued that when Congress puts conditions on necessary federal funds, like that's funds that are necessary for the states to accept, that it is coercing the states in a way that violates our federalism, our distribution of power between the federal governments and the states. Thus far, those sorts of arguments haven't gotten very far. Nonetheless, that was an argument that was made here. Some of the states said that, you know, the conditions attached to the health care bill, which require the states to open Medicaid and expand it far more than it presently exists, are coercive because no state really is in a practical position to reject Medicaid funding. Now, he rejects that argument.
Uh-huh.
The other argument, though, that he accepted has to do with the individual mandate. And the argument there was that while everybody acknowledges that that Congress has the power to regulate health care because health care, you know, a multi-billion-dollar industry obviously affects interstate commerce.
Yes.
What Congress doesn't have the power to do is regulate inactivity, and that's what it's doing here. It is punishing somebody's decision not to do something, and that is novel, according to the plaintiffs in this case and according to the states that joined this lawsuit. Never before, so the argument goes, has Congress required a person to engage in a transaction with a private entity under its Commerce Clause power, and that is unconstitutional. That's part one of the argument that Judge Vinson accepted.
Mm.
Part two of it relates to another provision of Article 1 of the Constitution. The Commerce Clause, by the way, is found in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and it just says that it gives Congress the power to regulate interstate and foreign commerce and commerce among the Indian tribes.
Hmm.
The 18th subsection of that same part of the Constitution, so Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, contains what's known as the elastic clause or the necessary and proper clause. And that's a provision which says that in pursuing any of the powers it is given, Congress has the power to also enact any necessary and proper measure that's appropriate for furthering an enumerated power, one of which is regulating interstate commerce. So Judge Vinson also rejected the argument made by the government that this is a proper use of the necessary and proper clause, this requirement of purchasing individual insurance. This is complicated. This is something we spend weeks on in constitutional law, so I'm hoping that you could feel free to ask any questions. I know I'm saying a lot of stuff kind of quickly, so I'm hoping this is making sense.
Well, it's very enlightening that, you know, the inaction. I saw that discussion and it's a very interesting point. I mean, you know, as a regular person, you know, being forced to buy health insurance, being forced, as you say, to take action, it does sound kind of onerous. Is there precedent for this? And maybe there's not, that to require an activity and to, as you say, punish inactivity. Does he have a strong case here, Judge Vincent?
Well, you know, I think he will have a strong case with certain theorists and judges and justices who share his reluctance to see a strong federal government, a nearly unlimited federal government in terms of its Commerce Clause power. Now, that said, I don't find the analysis particularly persuasive. First of all, I don't even accept the premise that the government doesn't ever require people to do things. I mean, it does. It requires you to register for the draft. In times of a draft, in times of conscription, it actually requires people to actively go to war or face a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Social Security. You can't opt out of Social Security, though we, of course, know that many people would like to do so.
Yeah.
That's a mandatory insurance scheme in which you are required to participate. More generally than that, I find the whole distinction drawn between action and inaction to be a bit of a legal fiction anyway. You know, one of the things we talk about in law school all the time is this power of characterization, that, you know, when a plaintiff brings a lawsuit, the plaintiff has the power to characterize the claim. And, you know, a claim for inaction, as the plaintiffs have characterized it here, can just as easily be recharacterized as a claim of action. Moreover, there are many instances in which inaction can give rise to legal liability. An example
True.
From another area of constitutional law would be if jailers fail to feed their prisoners. Now, that's inaction, and yet that can be regarded as a violation of the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel or unusual punishments. The distinction is formalistic, and it just doesn't hold up for me. That said, I do expect that there will be judges and justices who will be sympathetic to the argument.
Well, of course, the most important bunch of nine is the United States Supreme Court, and it's quite an interesting U.S. Supreme Court these days, the Roberts Court, with the likes of Alito on there and some of the other pretty right-wing justices. I can't really call them conservative because, you know, if you get down to what conservative means, I don't know what they're conserving. Is this, you know, and a lot of the people on the right complain about activist judges. Couldn't this Judge Vincent be called an activist judge? I mean, of course, that's a nebulous term, not a legal term, what an activist judge is, but it always struck me as an activist judge is one who makes a ruling that you don't like.
Well, absolutely. And, it's funny, you know, you make mention of how, you know, you don't think the term conservative is appropriate for at least some members of the Supreme Court. And, you know, we have a debate back and forth about activist judges. It all depends on the metrics you use to define the term. I mean, you know, words are signifiers, and they signify very different things to different people. And what is conservative to one person in 2011 is another person would regard as activist, a radical, reactionary. You know,
yeah.
There's all sorts of labels that we can put on that. I do think the fact remains that there are going to be, I think there will be some sympathy for this position if and when this case gets to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, you never know. You know, I mean, I always think back when I was teaching law school during the election of 2000. I remember going into my class and telling my students, I'll tell you one thing that I will predict, and it's that the Supreme Court will never get involved in this election dispute. I'm kind of referring again to Bush versus Gore.
I would have
labeled that as activism, you know, and yet it was something the court did. It was something that has been defended by all sorts of prominent commentators. So activism, I think, does tend to be in the eyes of the beholder. Now,
right.
That said, yes, there are certainly metrics along which this would be regarded as an activist decision. Certainly, some people would define activism as striking down the work of a coordinate branch of the federal government. There is a theory of constitutional interpretation that says that courts ought to defer to the coordinate political branches unless and until they're convinced of clear unconstitutionality. And I think it would be very hard to make the argument that this is clearly unconstitutional.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that it is unconstitutional at all.
We are talking about the recent decision striking down the bipartisan, and I want to emphasize that, bipartisan Affordable Care Act. This is UNH Law School Professor John Grebe, who is an expert in constitutional law, and it's unclear as to whether or not Republicans would be happy with this, because it struck me, my impression was that this whole requirement that insurance be purchased by everybody, as onerous as it sounds, was, I think, put in by Republicans. But nonetheless, it is the law of the land. It has been passed. There is that power of Congress. And the White House has, of course, doesn't like the decision. They call a decision overreaching. Speaking on behalf of the White House, Deputy Senior Advisor Stephanie Cutter said, "We don't believe this kind of judicial activism will be upheld. And we are confident that the Affordable Care Act will be ultimately declared constitutional by the courts." So what is next in the process for this? It's a long, well, how long of a ways is it between the Northern District Court of Florida and the U.S. Supreme Court? How many roadblocks and barricades might there be between here and there?
Well, the next step, if all goes as things usually go, and there's no reason to think that they won't, the next step is for the government, for the federal defendants in this case, to appeal this ruling to the Intermediate Federal Appeals Court, which would be the 11th Circuit, Florida. There are 11 numbered circuits around the country and a couple of other specialized circuits. Florida is within the 11th Circuit, so this appeal would go to the 11th Circuit. There will certainly be another appeal by the government of the decision handed down several weeks ago in Virginia. That will go to the 4th Circuit, because Virginia is within the 4th Circuit. Typically, that will mean that there'll need to be time for briefing and argument there and time for the appeals court to render a decision. And then, you know, at that point in time, the case will be ripe to go to the Supreme Court. Somebody can seek review in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court doesn't have to take it either. I think most observers think it unlikely that the court would pass on it, but the court's power to review a ruling such as this is discretionary.
Yes, they can say no, certainly. Boy, there's a lot to this, so it could take a long time, and of course this will be wonderful for attorneys of America as they get involved in it.
Yep, that's right.
Full Employment for Attorneys Act. I guess there are many such acts. Any guess as to what the U.S. Supreme Court might do if it went there as it is now, which, of course, is a lot of ifs in between?
Oh, you know, I've really, in the last few years, become much less impressed with my ability.
Yeah, well, that 2000
to prognosticate. You know, I do think it unlikely. With all the caveats,
right.
I do think it unlikely that the Supreme Court would strike this down. I do think there will be some votes to strike this down.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there is real vulnerability to the activity inactivity distinction argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think there's real vulnerability on the necessary and proper clause argument. The very fact that, I mean, to retreat for a moment to the judge's ruling, he decided that he wouldn't just sever out the individual mandate and strike it down, but rather that he would strike down the whole act because he accepted that the individual mandate is necessary for the whole act to work. The idea being that if people aren't forced to buy insurance, they'll hold back and wait until they're sick, and healthy people will not be participating in the insurance pool, which will drive up rates and make insurance unaffordable for everybody. And everybody agrees that, I think, I'm no expert on healthcare, but just based on my sort of news reading, it seems that there's broad agreement that without this individual mandate, something else would need to be supplied, that the rest of this act couldn't work very well. Now, if that's so, it's really hard to see how this isn't an appropriate measure to further the act itself. Everybody acknowledges that the act itself is regulating in an area where Congress does have the ability to act. I couldn't help but to notice yesterday that Charles Fried, who was the Solicitor General under Ronald Reagan, a very, very well-known and prominent conservative constitutional law scholar, gave a speech where he said he has no doubt that this act is constitutional.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I do think that there are many on the other side, if you will, other side from the Obama administration of the aisle, who do believe that this individual mandate is constitutional. I mean, it's certainly part of the Massachusetts plan that everybody predicts is going to be so problematic for Mitt Romney when he runs for president. Romney does have a response that is very principled, which is that, look, the federal government is a government of enumerated and defined powers, whereas the states are not. And whereas it's unconstitutional for the federal government to require this, it's perfectly constitutional for the states to require that somebody take action in this way. You know, whether that is an argument that'll resonate with the electorate is one thing, but it is a principal distinction drawn. It is true that the states do have powers that the federal government does not. But it's hard to predict. I tend to think that it will be upheld, but I've been wrong before. I think of Bush versus Gore,
right.
I was way wrong there. So.
Yes. Well, join the club. I've been wrong about a whole number of things, but in general. Just as an overarching question, in your opinion, Professor Grebe, does Congress have the constitutional power to regulate the insurance industry? Very simple question.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but
no,
absolutely. That is very well settled. I mean, the insurance industry is, of course, an interstate colossus. Now, the fact is that by congressional choice, a federal statute known as the McCarran-Ferguson Act that was passed in the 1940s, the states are given a great deal of power to regulate insurance. Now, that's a matter of federal choice, but there's no doubt that the Congress, under the Commerce Clause, does have the power to regulate health insurance, to my mind. And I don't think you'd find anybody who would seriously argue against that.
Well, it's interesting here in New Hampshire, the new Republican majority in the House is kind of angry at the Attorney General for the state that he has not joined in to a suit against the Health Care Act, the Health Care Reform Bill law referred to as Obamacare. But if you were the Attorney General of the state of New Hampshire, the idea is you're not there as a political vanguard. You're there to enforce the law. And do you think the Attorney General of the state of New Hampshire would be on strong ground supporting, joining in the suit against it on its alleged lack of constitutionality? Or is the Attorney General kind of doing the right and really necessary legal thing by staying out of it?
Well, under my view of the Constitution, I think it is appropriate for the Attorney General to stay on the sidelines. And I also think that beyond that, the notion of the legislature telling the Attorney General what to do raises really profound separation of powers concerns and questions, which is a separate constitutional matter, of course. But
that seems settled.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that seems settled, but go ahead.
Yep, and I think, I think so, too. But more generally, the power to regulate insurance generally and health insurance specifically, it's well established. I mean, unless we're going to roll back all of the Commerce Clause precedents that have been handed down since 1937, there's really no question about that. So it really all then comes down to the persuasiveness of this activity-inactivity distinction. And, for the reasons I stated before, I just don't see that as holding up at all.
Well, interesting. So we shall see in the next number of months as this goes on and on and on. One quick question. I don't know if it can be done quickly. I know that the U.S. Supreme Court struck down significant parts of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, as my impression was they thought it was government overreaching. But how was that finally settled? It seems that the ruling against the New Deal didn't hold permanently.
It didn't. I mean, that's the so-called Lochner era that we talk about when we cover basic constitutional law. It was a series of decisions that the Supreme Court handed down in the late 19th and then early 20th centuries, striking down efforts to regulate the business world, you know, post-industrial revolution. And one of the grounds by which federal legislation was struck down was the court holding that it exceeded Congress's Commerce Clause powers, just the precise same argument that's being made in these cases.
Yeah.
And there was also, state legislation being struck down as a violation of freedom to contract protected by the Due Process Clause. That came to a head in 1937 when a frustrated president proposed a statute that would have required that a justice retire at the age of 70 or take senior status at the very least, and would have expanded membership on the Supreme Court. And this was known as the court packing plan.
Yeah, well.
So whether it was coincidental or not, shortly after that plan was introduced, Justice Owen Roberts switched his vote in one of these Commerce Clause cases, and that became known as the switch in time that saved nine. Roosevelt's court packing plan died in Congress, and from 1937 until 1995, the Supreme Court didn't strike down any federal legislation as being beyond Congress's Commerce Clause power.
Interesting. Well, very interesting stuff. What can I say? I love the law. I think it's fascinating, having worked in a law factory for all those years known as the legislature, as opposed to the court, which reviews the laws. You're right, two separate things. UNH Law School Professor John Grebe, thank you so much for being with us and helping to explain. I'm a little more confident about it than I was before. Thanks very much.
Okay, anytime, Bert. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And do email me with your comments and suggestions, questions, new ideas for shows, Bert, B-U-R-T, at thebertcohenshow.com. Well, we'll see if the healthcare law sticks.
Well, I got the TV, and the TV is all in my bones. Long. Well, the TB is all right to have, but your friend treats you so low down. Do for me.